Do you understand the words that are coming out of my mouth?
Quiet, numbskulls, I'm broadcasting.
Can we get serious now?
One thing that did happen during the 60s was some music of an unusual or experimental nature did get recorded and did get released. Now look at who the executives were in those companies at those times. Not hip young guys. These were cigar-chomping old guys who looked at the product that came and said, I don't know. Who knows what it is? Record it, stick it out of it, sells, all right. We were better off with those guys than we are now with the supposedly hip young executives who are making the decisions of what people should see and hear in the marketplace.
Success in the music business begins with a dream, a vision. This podcast will give you, the listener, the insight and tools to turn that vision into a reality. Meet the industry professionals who work day by day behind the scenes, helping to make those dreams come true. Welcome to the business side of music.
20 studio albums, including one platinum and two gold records. 20 singles at country radio, six of which went top five, including your number one hit, Your Love Amazes Me. CMA Horizon Award winner, Grammy nominated artist for Your Love Amazes Me, along with a Grammy win for your participation in Amazing Grace, a country salute to gospel. He has a TV show, Songs and Stories with John Barry on the Family Channel, Heartland TV, and Bride TV. And you now have a bi-weekly podcast series with your wife, Robin, called Faith, Family, and Friends, including a very touching episode with country legend Charlie Daniels, which was his very last interview that we're going to talk about here in a bit. John Barry, welcome to the show.
Well, thank you. It's good to be with you.
So how did you get started? You started playing at a young age. Were you an athlete? How did you get around to doing this?
Tried out for the football team, and I was standing on the field. All of a sudden, I saw the cross-country guys run by, and I said, okay. I was trying out for the kickoff receiver, and I'm standing there, and a cross-country guy's run by. I went, I can run, and nobody's going to tackle me if I'm on that team. So I joined the cross-country team, and I ended up being a really fine runner. I missed the first meet because I didn't know about cross-country at the time, but then I joined, and I won every meet I ran for the rest of that season. And then Thanksgiving break came up. I said, on Wednesday, we got out of school, say goodbye to all your friends, have a great weekend, we'll see you next Monday. Got home Saturday, we moved.
Oh my gosh.
Had no idea. We lived in Atlanta suburb, Decatur, Georgia, to Chamblee, Georgia, which is the other side of Atlanta. Oh, well, actually, it's not the other side. It's about 9 miles up two roads.
Yeah.
But whole new school district, whole new community, same county.
Yeah.
But just whole different. So my life completely uprooted. And so I went to a school where the only person I knew in the entire building was my older brother. And you know how older brothers are with their right. younger brothers. So I knew no one except that six-string friend of mine. As a matter of fact, the cross-country coach at this new school was ecstatic I was there. I ran the county meeting, you know, but the cross-country coach at my new school was ecstatic. And I never ran. I was so upset. I was so emotionally distraught about this whole move.
Yeah.
I never ran cross-country again. But I sure spent a lot of time playing the guitar.
And your musical influences being, I guess, Harry Chapin was one of them, John Denver, James Taylor.
Yeah.
Was it something you aspired to be, or did they inspire you at that time to be a songwriter? Did you want to be like them, or what was that all about?
Well, I think it was music that I was capable of playing, even though I love stuff like, matter of fact, I was driving down here and this Bad Company song came on. I love Bad Company and some of these rock and roll bands, but I just never learned to play like that. Matter of fact, I've got 4 or 5 wonderful electric guitars and I got a great amp rig and pedal board and all this stuff. And I'm not even taking it on a Christmas tour. I'm not.
Wow.
I just don't, you know, it's not my gift. I think my voice lent itself to that kind of music, you know.
Before the show, we talked about your dad was into Van Cliburn. Your mom was into gospel music.
Yeah.
I mean, this two opposite ends of the musical spectrum. You know, Van Cliburn is very classical, and then you have the gospel end of it. Did either one influence you more than the other?
Well, I think the biggest influence was, you know, of course, around our house, I had an older brother and older sister. And my sister and her friends would listen to the top 40 radio stuff. And there was a radio station in Atlanta, WQXI 79 AM. And we'd listen to that station all the time. Us kids would play out my dad's garage all the time, shop out there and stuff. And he had this breadbox size AM radio sat on the shop table. And we just listened to Gary McKee, the morning DJ on 79 AM. And he'd just play all this cool music, man. I mean, every singer-songwriters, and you'd hear Charlie Daniels Band, and then you'd hear the Shy Lights and the Stylistics, and then you'd hear "And When We Get Behind Closed Doors," you know, Charlie same Rich, station, yeah. You know. When I started playing guitar, I heard Almost Heaven, West Virginia, you know, and yeah. It's like I could figure that out. But it was just a real love for that kind of music. And I started high school and I took a guitar class because it's an easy grade. But one of the guys in my class, he said, "You ever heard of Cat Stevens?" And I'm like, "Who?" I'd never heard of Cat Stevens. And so he turned me on to some Cat Stevens. I was like, "Oh, shut up!" I learned Father and Son, you know, And those were songs that I could play on the guitar and sing. That sort of became the avenue I went after. Because I was never in a band. You know, a lot of guys put bands together. I never did that. So I would do music that I didn't need a band to play. I could just do me and sing songs. So
growing up as you did, obviously wasn't, for lack of better terms, wasn't a big country music influence other than maybe Charlie Rich.
No, just Hee Haw on Saturday nights.
Saturday nights Hee Haw. Yeah. But you moved to Nashville to seek a record deal. Was country music on your radar?
Actually, I didn't. I never really thought about coming to Nashville. It was never on my radar. I was just making records on my own. I moved to Athens, Georgia in 1984, I think it was. I got a friend of mine. She used to come hear me play in Atlanta. She said, "I'm living up here in Athens. I never get to hear you play. If I get you a gig up here, will you come up here and play?" So I think it was spring of 84. She booked me this club 5 nights a week. Every other week, so I'd play a week, off a week, play a week, off a week, play a week. So for over a 5-week period, I played 3 weeks. By the end of that 3 weeks, they booked me for the summer, because that was in the spring, so they booked me for the whole summer, 5 nights a week, every week. I ended up playing at club for 2 years.
Wow.
Over that time, I bought a little piece of land north of Athens out in the country. We built my bass player, Mike Steele, who's still playing bass with me, we had a huge following. I mean, the first 2 years we played this little club, the room held 98 people. The fire marshal shut us down one night for having 800 people in this building. It was crazy. It was just nuts. And we had so much fun. We ended up moving, then we started playing different clubs around Athens. In the meantime, you know, I ended up buying this little 5 acres, and then I bought 5 acres next door, and 5 acres next door, and 8 acres next door, and 43 across the street, and 63 next to that. And built us this little farmhouse, built my mother-in-law a house out there, built us a nice big barn and office, and we just had this thing going on with Nashville. It's never...
You were just making it on your own.
Yeah, we're just doing my thing.
Yeah.
Armadillo style.
Yeah.
So I was driving, I was playing a club in Athens. We'd actually gone to... This guy had hired me to play this club. He said, "I want you to come play every Saturday night, and I'll pay you what you've been making for a week." I was like, "Shit, sounds good to me."
Yeah.
He said, "The only thing is you can't play anywhere else in Athens. You can play anywhere 60 miles away, but you're playing Athens, you're playing here."
Your first radius clause.
Yeah. I said,
yeah.
"I'm in."
Yeah.
So we did. And I was driving home late one night. I lived our farm was about 18 miles north of town. And I was driving out there one night. DJ said, "Turn it up, brand new Joe Diffie song." Man, I cranked it up. I love Joe Diffie. And Joe sang "Ships That Don't Come In." He was singing to me. Nobody else in the world was listening.
Yeah.
And he said, "And to those who stand on empty shores and spit against the wind, and for those who wait forever for ships that don't come in."
So here's to all the soldiers who have ever died in vain, the insane locked up in themselves, the homeless down on Main. To those who stand on empty shores and spit against the wind, don't come in.
And it occurred to me at one time I dreamed bigger than being just a big old fish in the little pond of Athens, Georgia. And I got home, had tears in my eyes, and I woke Robin up and I said, "Baby," I told her about this song and Joe sang, and I said, "I've dreamed bigger than this." I said, "We got to try. See if we got anything here." So we sat up, we came up with a plan to go to Nashville every 6 weeks. We were going to do a little industry showcase at these little songwriter clubs, whatever they are, you know. We're going to do one, send out invitations 2 weeks before, do it, wait 2 weeks to hear again, then give a 2-week rest, and then send out invitations again, give it 2 weeks, do it. Do that cycle every 6 weeks. We did our first one in spring of 92. February of 92 is when Joe Diffie's song Ships That Don't Come In came out. In May of 92, we did our first industry showcase at Douglas Corner. We sent out 200, I was an ASCAP writer at the time, and we had that industry showcase list, you know. And I sent out 250 invitations. Had no idea what happened, you know. So we got to Douglas Corner, and there were a few friends and family from around the area that came. We had a few stragglers, a few regulars that go to Douglas Corner. And of our invitation list, one guy showed up.
Oh.
One guy. I was like, great. But afterwards, he said, hey, let's go get a bite to eat. Let's go get a bite breakfast before we head out of town. And so before the close up the night. So we did. We went to Waffle House and sat around, talked for a while, and then we headed out. Next morning, Herky Williams calls me back, and, hey, man, that was a great set last night and great breakfast. He said, if you're free this morning, Jimmy Bowen wants you to come over and have brunch at his place. I said, dude, we're already back in Athens. He said, what? Yeah, I said, yeah, we ain't got no money for hotels. We just turned around and went back home. So they ended up setting up a private showcase for us to get together with Bowen, and did a showcase for him, and along with him, David Corlew from Charlie Daniels Group.
Right.
And Tom O'Grady, who was his partner at the time, and John Huey from Creative Artists was there. So just a handful of fellas, you know. We did our six songs and with my band and my wife singing with me. And afterwards, Bowen, he said, well, he said, I like what you're doing. He said, I like you just doing what you do, doing your thing. And he said, I guess you came here looking for a record deal. And I said, yes, sir, I did. He said, well, Corley, are you going to represent him? And he said, if John wants me to, I'll represent him. He said, all right, y'all call me next week. Let's put this deal together.
Wow.
We went to little place down on West End, got a bite to eat afterwards. And Mr. O'Grady, I don't know if you ever met Tom O'Grady, who was David Corley's partner with Corley O'Grady Management. And Mr. O'Grady was a very wealthy man from Connecticut area. He retired as the vice president of U.S. Tobacco. Very, very Irishman. Yeah, I just loved him. He passed away a few years back, but just a wonderful man. But he got me kind of just to the side, and he said, I guess you're wondering why you never come to Nashville before. I said, well, it kind of crossed my mind. He said, you weren't supposed to come before.
Whoa.
He said, all the stars lined up today. He said, come before may not have been tonight's the night. So it was a pretty cool deal. And that was in 92. And we didn't move to Nashville till 99. I ran my time with Capitol, and then I had signed with Lyric Street Records. We moved here August of 99. And I wasn't very easy to get along with. As far as labels were concerned, I was a bit of an arrogant pain in the ass. And they decided they'd had enough. So they sent me an email and the first week of December and cut me loose. So I don't blame them. You know, I was a pain. The straw that broke the camel's back, other than me going by their office complaining they weren't doing anything, they had given away a show. And shows at that time were selling for like 20 grand. I was there doing the free show and met with the PD at the station, and they had no intentions of playing our new record that we had out. They didn't like it and weren't going to play it. And I had just given them a $20,000 show. And I called the record label, and they happened to be in a staff meeting. I said, oh, perfect. Put me on speaker. Next thing I know, I'm out.
Yeah.
So it's a lot to be said for humility, which I didn't have at the time. So to all the guys and gals at Lyric Street Records that were there, I apologize profusely. I didn't mean to be such a jerk.
We're going to take a little break, get a word in for one of our sponsors, and we'll come back.
Who's your sponsor? Let me say something nice about him.
Say nice things about Larry Butler.
Come on, Larry.
We're going to take a little break, get a word in for our sponsor, Larry Butler. And when we come back, we're going to have some more conversation with John Barry.
You're listening to The Business Side of Music.
Hi, everyone. I'm Larry Butler, and I want to send you a free digital copy of my new book, The Singer-Songwriter Rulebook, 101 Ways to Help You Improve Your Chances of Success. That's right. Everything you need to know to launch your career as a singer-songwriter, all based on my 40 years in the live performance arena. And believe me, I've seen it all. In my book, you'll find the 10 things you have to deal with before even thinking about becoming a singer-songwriter-performer. You'll also learn about the 5 things every singer-songwriter can do this weekend to make their live show better. 5 things I can guarantee that you are not doing already. Plus, there's tips on songwriting and staging, photo and video shoots, publishing, merch, dozens of other topics, all written for people who don't particularly like to read. And again, it's free. Just go to the Business Side of Music website homepage and look for my book cover. Click on it, and a free digital copy of my book will be yours. I'm Larry Butler, and I approve of this message. Thanks.
Are you curious about Gordon Lightfoot's songwriting process or what it was like working with Prince in the 80s? Have you ever given any thought to what goes into a golf course design or writing a book? I'm Steve Waxman, the host of The Creationist, a podcast about people who create. Each episode features a different creator sharing stories that I hope will inspire your own creativity. The Creationist is available now on Apple, Spotify, or wherever you listen to podcasts.
You're listening to The Business Side of Music.
Back in the studio, sitting across the console from me here, John Barry. You have accomplished a lot, as we talked about in the very beginning, but there's a couple other things you have going on in the world right now. Of course, first of all, let's talk about, I believe it's your 24th annual Songs and Stories with John Barry Christmas Tour.
Yeah.
We talked about this just a little bit before the show, but tours aren't what they were. But you're actually going out and doing some dates, right?
Well, a whole six this year.
Yeah, well, that's better than some acts right
yeah,
now.
Yeah, we'll be in Athens, Georgia, Bremen, Georgia, and Macon, Georgia. And we've played all three of those just about every year. Macon, Georgia, this will be our 24th year.
Gotcha.
And then we'll be in Indiana, in Jeffersonville, Indiana, and here in Gallatin, Tennessee, and Dothan, Alabama.
And then you're playing the Grand Ole Opry too, right?
We'll play Grand Ole Opry the night before the first show of the tour. The first show of the tour is in Gallatin on the 12th. Yeah. We'll play the Grand Ole Opry on the 11th.
The music that you're playing on the show all Christmas, you doing any
no,
of your
we're
hits?
We're going to open with some hits. Normally, in recent years, we've done a two-part show with an intermission. We do about 40 minutes of hits and new songs, intermission, and about an hour and 10 of Christmas. This year, due to COVID and a lot of these houses are half house, I guess they all are half house, we're doing a straight through show so people can come in, get their seats, enjoy the show, and then leave, not get up during intermission and intermingle and all that stuff. I hate it, but.
Have you done this type of a setup yet, or is this, because you've done this, I guess, for 23 years before,
yeah,
to practically full houses, and now all of a sudden you're going into half houses.
Yeah.
Is this going to be a new adventure for you?
Oh, yeah, it's going to be real different. Like the first show, Gallatin, the little palace theater, only seats 204 people. So half house is, you know, 102.
Yeah.
So it'd be like being in the living room of a big house, you know. It'll be different. You know, it's like Charlie Daniels said, don't look at the empty seats.
Yeah. I would think the intimate show would be, in some ways, more endearing because of the,
well,
you're able to see your audience and interact with them, and you're not being blinded by spotlights.
Well, some of the horrible part of it all is like Dothan, Alabama, the opera house that we play at there, seats 850. We're moving across the street to the Civic Center, and they're allowing us to have 600, I think. Seats 3,500.
Yeah, social distancing.
Yeah, so there's going to be lots of empty seats. Same thing with Macon, Georgia. Macon, Georgia seats 1,200. They had already sold 600 seats. Because in Macon, like I said, we've been there every year. When we finished the show last year, this year's show went on sale. As you're walking out the door, you can get tickets for 2020 at the end of 2019. You can pick up your tickets on your way out the door. And we sold half the house that night. Well, along comes COVID.
Yeah.
So we had to move to the City Auditorium, which seats 3,000, 3,200, and the capacity is 650.
The songs you've recorded, now I'm going to go way back, probably late 90s, early 2000s. You did something, was it Old Holy Night with Chuck Howard?
1995.
Going farther back.
Yeah.
You did that with Chuck Howard.
Yeah.
Did that get released as a single?
It did. Actually, we recorded it in June of 94. It had been scheduled for several months because Chuck and I had been, we'd put my first album out. And of course, he had heard us talk about our Christmas show we were doing in Athens because we do it every year in Athens starting in 1989. And we talked about this Old Holy Night song and what a great response we get. He said, we should go in and record a couple Christmas things. This was like winter of 93, 94. We should go record a few things, see what we got. Well, we scheduled first week of June while we're in town for fanfare. Let's go record a couple songs while we're in town. We cut Old Holy Night and O Come Emmanuel. What we didn't know, what was not on the schedule, is 30 days before that I was going to end up having brain surgery.
Oh, my gosh.
Everybody's like, oh, we need to cancel the sessions. I said, no, don't cancel. I need a distraction. So those dates came along. Everybody was real concerned about doing it and all that. And so we go in and we're recording this, and I can't remember the recording session very well because I just had brain surgery. I don't remember much of anything. But it was real emotional cutting those songs. For me to be in the studio recording songs that I love so much, because somewhere there's a videotape of me sitting in my old office on our old farm. Day before we left to go to the hospital in Atlanta for brain surgery, Rob and my wife had to go run some errands, take care of our little girl and some other things. And I sat down in my office and recorded all the songs that I loved because I knew they were going to find more than they bargained for. And I walked around my farm and talked about when we built the house and when I bought the land and the little shed that I lived in the first 2 years before Robin and I got married and we built the house and all this stuff. But there's all these songs I recorded, you know. So to be in a studio 30 days later recording, yeah. Oh Holy Night, it was real emotional. Connie Ellisor, the violinist, her violin kept going out of tune when she's recording her parts. And Chuck Howard asked her across the headphones, she said, Connie, what's going on with your violin? World-class violinist. You know, that doesn't happen. She said, well, I'm sitting here listening to John sing, knowing a month ago we were praying he'd survive, much less sing again. And she said, tears are streaming down my face and they're falling on my violin and it's making it go out of tune.
Oh, holy night, the stars are brightly shining. It is the night of our dear Savior's birth. Long lay the world in sin and error pining, till he appeared and the soul felt its worth. A thrill of hope the weary soul rejoices, for yonder breaks a new
stuff you can't make up, stuff you can't create, stuff you can't, let's go in and let's make the violinist cry and make her violin go out of tune. You can't make that stuff up. So we captured a little photograph of an emotional moment that was uncreatable, and somehow turned it into digital information and put it on a CD, and somebody spins it 25 years later and they can still feel it. That's a recording session.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow.
So they made a CD single of that song and put it in a little card, Christmas card.
I actually have a copy of that around here somewhere still.
They sent it out to everybody, a radio and just people around town, and just said thank you for all the support through a very difficult, trying year. Not looking for airplay on a 5.5-minute Christmas song. You're not getting airplay on that. And somebody spun it, and off it went. Everybody felt it.
The Christmas project you have out now, titled Christmas, is that rendition of Holy Night on that? You have another rendition.
It's the only time we've done another studio version.
Yeah.
We re-recorded it, and we tried to make it a little different. Instead of being piano-driven, it's nylon string guitar-driven, and so it's a little bit different, but because we didn't want to try and beat that. You can't beat that.
Yeah.
You can do something a little different, but you can't beat that original recording because it's, like I said, something you can't make up.
picking the songs for that, you've got a few on there. Obviously, Mary Did You Know?
Yeah.
Which is, when I listen to it, it's a little bit of a rocking version.
A little bit. It's like, oh my gosh. I bet the folks listening went, what have they done?
Well, I remember when we released Michael English's version at the label of Mary Did You Know? And to me, it was just heart-wrenching.
Yeah.
And then your rendition is like, man, it's got some electricity to it when you get it out there.
Yeah, it's electric. It's a lot of power. Brent Mason playing guitars. And it's just a rock ballad is what it is. It's a big old rock ballad. And it's emotion driving, you know. It's very emotional.
Yeah. And then, of course, Blue Christmas.
Yeah, that was real different. Because I've not been a fan of that song over the years because people treated it with humor. And it's not a funny song. My understanding is Elvis did not like the song, but he was being forced to cut it by the label. So he threw these background vocals on there to goof with them.
Right.
Ended up being a big old hit. Everybody remembered those vocals, those background vocals. But I'm looking at it as a singer-songwriter, as a Harry Chapin, as a James Taylor, as a John Denver. It's a really sad song. And so I told the guys when we were cutting it, I said, I want to treat it like James Taylor. That's exactly that guitar lick. Brent Mason went, he did that little guitar lick just like a James Taylor song. Because that's how that song should have been approached all along. It's different than all the other versions out there. But I think because if you really listen to this song, he's on his own, man. He is spending the holidays without the one he loves, and it's a sad moment.
I'll have a blue Christmas without you. I'll be so blue just thinking about you. Decorations of red on a green Christmas tree won't be the same if you're not here with me. And when those blue snowflakes start falling, that's when those blue memories start calling. You'll be doing all right.
I don't want to rush this Christmas. Where did that song come from? I got to tell you hear so many Christmas songs, but it's always the same ones.
Yeah.
You got some on here like Joseph's Lullaby and I Don't Want to Rush This Christmas.
Yeah, Joseph's Lullaby, I love singing that song. It's a song, it's from the point of view of Joseph, who knows that this baby is not his. It's this baby was conceived by the Holy Spirit. This is a son of God. But he's got the moment. I got chills. Think about it. He's for this moment, he gets to be the dad.
Yeah.
He's not the father, but he's the dad, you know. He gets to raise this child in hopes that he'll raise it in a way as honoring to God, you know. It's a really beautiful, beautiful song. I wish I'd penned that one, but I sure loved getting to sing it. What a magical point of view to write a song from the point of view, because that's not someone that's talked a lot about.
Right.
You know, the Catholicism is Mary and all that sort of stuff. And a lot of the focus, of course, at Christmas is the birth of Jesus and the virgin birth of Mary. But what about Joseph? You know, it's a great moment. And I think people have really dug the song live. I think people really get the song. And I Don't Want to Rush This Christmas. It's just a song I wrote with some friends here in town. And just an idea, because it's just like this. It's real straightforward, you know, about the hustle and bustle of Christmas time. And let's kind of get past all that and just focus on what it's really about.
I want to ask you, with obviously the health issues that you've had, the battle with cancer and the treatment that you went through, do you look at Christmas entirely different than you used to, or has it always been a very important time for you?
I look at every day different. Yet I don't know how I could have ignored the cancer, because mine was, it was a tumor in my throat. I mean, you could see it. You could literally see the tumor.
Mm-hmm.
You could look down my throat and there it was. So, but had it been ignored for any length of time, there may not have been much more they could do. I don't know.
Yeah. But
And who knows what that road would have led to, but we're grateful that they were able to do something that eradicate it. But it does give a great deal of appreciation for every day the sun comes up.
We're going to take another break, get another word in for another one of our sponsors. When we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about The Richest Man, which you dedicated to your dad, along with your podcast series that you and your wife have.
All right.
You're listening to The Business Side of Music.
My name is Garrett Hope. I am a composer, coach, podcaster, and speaker. I've been focused on building my music business since the early 2000s and helping others build their music businesses since 2015. I want to tell you about a free event I'm organizing for January. It's called the Ultimate Music Business Summit. It'll take place January 7, 8, and 9. Here's the deal. Through the summit, I want to help you build your own stimulus package for 2021. There will be over 21 teachers giving over 21 high-leverage business lessons you can use in your music business immediately so you can make 2021 the best year for your music ever. If you want to make more money with your music, grow your audience, or impact more people, this summit is for you. More than that, there will be a few live panel discussions so we can discuss this in real time. It's going to be amazing. And yes, it's free. This summit will give you real world, not theoretical, strategies you can implement immediately. I promise you, with all the teachers lined up, you'll get something you've never thought of before. Even though building a business is hard, and trust me, no one is promising it's easy, it is possible. You just need the right tools and strategies. Get your free ticket today and reserve your spot in the summit. Build your own stimulus package for 2021. I look forward to seeing you at the summit. Go to musicsummit.biz, that's musicsummit.biz, to get your ticket today.
You're listening to The Business Side of Music.
Back in the studio, John Barry's with us today. The Richest Man, you dedicated that to your dad.
Yeah, I wrote that with Liz Hingber and Will Robinson. Got together with them to write one day, and of course I knew their work and had met Will once before briefly, and being the wonderful writers that they were asking a lot of questions about me and my life that we might be able to write something that would be right in line for me to record and to sing. And got talking about family and got talking about my father. I'd never looked at writing a song about my dad. I loved my father and he was a very inspiring man, but I had a song I'd recorded on an album, a song written by John Greenenbaum and Troy Seals, called 40 Again, that I would always tell this long, involved story about my dad and then do the song 40. I wish my dad was 40 again. He would be young and I would be 10, you know. Beautiful song. So I had a song about my dad. I didn't need to write a song about my dad, even though I hadn't written this one. I had one. But this one just, we started goofing around and playing with some lyrics and melody, and out on the table it spilled, you know. We finished it, and Will's, he said, "Well, I wish we'd written that one." I said, what are you talking about? He goes, "We didn't write that one. We were gifted that one."
Wow.
You know, so it's just one of those songs that just, we didn't make it up.
Yeah.
I made up a song. You know, not this time.
Yeah.
This song, we just gifted us. And
is songwriting, does it come easy to you?
No. No. I don't like to write songs. I like them when they're done.
Yeah.
I don't like the night before I'm going. I try to get out of it the morning of. But once I get there, I'm going, I'm okay.
Yeah.
I had a songwriting appointment not recently with Will and Liz again, because I had an idea for a song. And even though it was my idea, I was like, oh, y'all just write it and call me, you know. But we actually did it on Zoom, and we've got to get together and do a tweaking on it. But we wrote a song together called The Long Goodbye. And its inspiration and its moments are written about my wife and her mother, who has Alzheimer's.
Mm.
And so it's the long goodbye. With the dementia and Alzheimer's, it's a constant goodbye, you know?
Yeah.
And it's actually, I wanted to stay clear of writing another, even though it's an emotional song, where like The Richest Man is a ballad, and this song is more of a mid-tempo, got a little drive to it, kind of like Standing on the Edge of Goodbye had. So it's a little different.
Talking about your wife, Robin, you two now have a bi-weekly podcast series out there called Faith, Family, and Friends, including, from what I read, a very touching episode with Charlie Daniels.
Amazing.
Which, which was his last interview, from what I understand.
It was an amazing. We refer to them as conversations. We don't. We just want us to talk. We don't have a list of questions. We don't go in there with things to talk about. We just talk.
Yeah.
As a result, I end up with about 2 hours worth of material. I had to edit it down, try and get into 45 minutes. Yeah. So lots of editing. But we talked to Charlie Daniels on July 1st. And that following, I think it was July the 5th, he passed away. Or 6th, 5th or 6th.
But you said it was a great conversation.
It was a great conversation. And in the first 19 minutes, he talks about being in heaven three times.
Oh my gosh. Wow.
Talks about his farm and how much he loves his farm. He said, but it's going to be nothing compared to heaven.
Yeah.
It was a great conversation. Of course, you know, David Corlew represented me when I first signed with Capitol, and I worked with him for 5 or so years, and just sweet people, dear people. And Charlie was always very kind, even though I'd see him periodically, but not a lot. But he was always so, like everybody who saw Charlie, he was very kind and very forthcoming. For the time you have Charlie, you feel like you're his best friend in the world. You know, you really do. He just had that gift of
making. He makes you feel that way.
He makes people feel like you're his best friend. And he means it. He's not doing it in a fake. There's no fakeness about it. It was real. It's when he had that moment with you, you're the only thing that mattered. And it was awesome. It's a real gift he had. And not to manipulate anybody or manipulate a conversation or anything. It's just who he was. He made people feel very welcome. It was just my time there with Corlew O'Grady Management and being at CDB at their offices and things like that. It's great, fond memories and a lot of great guidance as I continued on into the music business. And I know over these next few years will be a difficult time for the CDB folks.
Yeah.
Adjusting to the fact that Charlie's no longer there with them physically. And
with the podcast series, going in new directions with it, it's biweekly. People need to subscribe to it.
Yeah. We're actually, the first year we're going to start doing on 1st and 15th. Instead of every other Friday, we're going to do 1st and 15th. It just makes more sense. It's easier to keep track of.
Yeah.
But we just did Scott Hamilton 2 weeks ago.
Scott Hamilton, the Olympic skater.
Yes. This week, Kim Campbell's conversation with us is up right now. And what an amazing, amazing conversation we had. You know, she came from a broken home. Her mom remarried a wonderful man. They moved to the coast in North Carolina. And she grew up there and had a love for music and a love for dancing. She still dances now, all these years later. And then she met, matter of fact, she was a Rockette. She met Glenn. And her Wyatt life was a whirlwind for a long time. And she is very open, talks about those first years that they were together and the good parts of that, but then the difficult parts with Glenn's addictions, and then the 7 years they had that were just beautiful when he got sober and had these 7 years of just marital bliss, you know, just great, great time together before dementia, before he fell victim to that. And then she talks about the difficult road that was. She was very forthcoming. There was no holds barred. It was a great conversation. She was very, very pleasant to talk with, and she shared her heart.
How can people find John Barry these days, social media-wise?
Well, all our social medias are John Barry Music. Of course, our website is johnbarry.com, and you can find links to anything at johnbarry.com. Our Facebook page, of course, is John Barry Music. Our website at johnbarry.com, there's a banner about faith, family, and friends, and you can click there to subscribe. And there's two different levels. You can be a friend or family member. It's a $15 a month subscription, but you get the podcast and two of those a month. And then there's a newsletter goes out and a couple other things. Or for just a few dollars more, you can be a faithful member, which gets you the podcast and the newsletter and that. And then also every other month, Robin and I, we send everybody an invitation to come to a particular web address, and we do a performance and question and answers exclusive for our faithful followers. And we're getting ready to do another one of those. We'll put a little message out for about 2 weeks, let everybody know it's coming and to join us. And it's always a lot of fun. Get lots and lots of questions. Our daughter-in-law comes and she'll sit there and get the questions in order for us. And so it helps us keep track of it. So we get everybody covered, you know.
John, thank you so much for being on the show. This was great.
Well, thank you. Appreciate you letting me come and share with your audience. Hopefully we'll get to see you again soon.
The Business Side of Music is the creation of Tom Sabella and Tracy Snow and is produced by Bob Bender. The Business Side of Music is recorded at Music Dog Studios in Nashville, Tennessee. Production sound design by Keith Stark. Voiceover and promo by Lisa Busan.